Welcome to the Show Means Two podcast. I'm Zach Lawhorn from Show Me Opportunity, and today I'm joined by David Stokes, Avery Frank, and Elias Chappellis from Show Me Institute. Elias, you've got a new paper out at showmeinstitute.org today. It's a primer about Missouri's Hancock Amendment. So I want to start top level. Tell people, first of all, what is the Hancock Amendment?
Sure. Well, the Hancock Amendment is something that I think most Missouri voters, or at least homeowners, have had, or at least been impacted by at some point, whether they knew it or not. It is a tax and expenditure limit, which essentially means that Missouri voters should have more of a say in whether the government is growing. And if it's growing too fast, they should get some of their tax dollars back. I guess at the top level, that's really what it's about. And Missouri voters approved that in 1980.
So where would the average Missouri voter run into this in reality? This is something that a tax is proposed and they get a say on if that tax is implemented or not?
Sure. And you see that mostly in local governments. When there are different taxes that come up and you go vote, there's a lot of those you'll see at the local level. At the state level, you haven't seen that as much. Where you see it, the state level would have been more back in the 1990s when Missourians received some tax refunds. That was part of the Hancock Amendment. And then once again, at the local level, homeowners see it whenever their property tax rates get rolled back after assessments go up.
There was some talk of, and I think we talked about it on the podcast, but a couple of years ago when the gas tax was raised here in Missouri, there was some talk about whether that violated the Hancock Amendment or not. Is that tell me about that situation and what we know a couple of years now on from the gas tax decision.
Well, I would certainly argue that the gas tax probably did violate the Hancock Amendment, but it really was kind of a driving force behind this primer, because really there's a lot of unclear issues with the Hancock Amendment that just haven't been resolved. Even though it is, you know, over 40 years old, there are a few pieces here that really haven't been tested. Now, the Hancock Amendment has been subject to a variety of legal challenges, but the piece of the gas tax that is really sort of up for debate that hasn't been challenged is the idea of how much the state can raise taxes without voters weighing in. And what presumably I'll get into a little bit later is what the legislature has found out is that if a tax goes into effect over multiple years, the Hancock Amendment doesn't really have a way to kind of stop that from going into effect or requiring voters to weigh in on it as it would if the gas tax would have went into effect at one time.
Okay, so what do we do? You've got this whole paper on it. Let's condense it down. What do we need to do to fix the Hancock Amendment?
Sure. So there's a few pieces of the Hancock Amendment that need addressing. So I guess I can just start with a tax cap piece. So that was involving the gas tax, was essentially the piece that Missouri voters approved in 1996 that said that the legislature cannot raise taxes or fees over a certain amount in a given legislative session. And so what has happened over time, the legislature figured out how to sort of get around that. And so there's basically some definitions that need to be fixed there and how compliance will be determined so that it can kind of be tightened up. Now, when there's other parts of the amendment that also need to be addressed that we've included in the blueprint, and David has even talked about some of it before, the first piece being that Missourians haven't received a refund from the tax amendment in over 20 years now. And the reason for that is that the one of the main provisions of this amendment was the revenue ceiling and refund. What essentially happened was that the way that the revenue ceiling was determined or was calculated, it essentially just stopped working about 20 years ago after the growth of the 1990s. And then there was the recession in the early 2000s. And now that piece is never going to work again. And part of the reason that it doesn't work is because the formula that was used is tied to the personal income of Missourians in 1979. It is something that has grown incredibly out of date. The constitutional amendment used dates from 1980. It used a definition of Missouri revenues that was basically what the governor put out in 1980. And so Missouri's government looks a lot different today. And without updating essentially what revenues are included, tax credits, for example, aren't included. So that's part of the reason Missouri has a lot of tax credit programs, because it sort of helps go around the Hancock Amendment. So you update those, update the formula to include, up-to-date years. You essentially allow for more refunds. Essentially, Missourians would have received a refund a few years ago, because the idea is if... So the original idea behind this, I guess, would make the most sense is, so without raising taxes, revenues can go up by a lot. You know, whether the economy is performing well, there's inflation. And so what the voters were saying in 1980 was essentially, if the government receives all of this revenue, that should not essentially, without raising taxes, that should not go towards growing government. And if that happens, they should get some of that money back. And essentially what has happened with this formula being out of date and some of the issues with it is that it's not constraining government anymore. That's why we have, a state budget that has grown by about double over the last 5 years. And so now we're looking back and saying, hey, this tax expenditure limit, it's not limiting taxes. It's not limiting expenditures. And so now it's time for something better.
So we've got this outdated amendment. It's like an old car. We've got a bunch of work we have to do, pop the hood, fix a bunch of things, or we could go get a new car. We could do something completely different. You said time for something better. In the paper, you have an idea, a proposal, and what would that be?
Well, so I say let's look to Colorado, the state that has the best tax and expenditure limit in America. It's called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. And what it does is it kind of abandons some of Missouri's old approaches, which frankly are just out of date. What we've learned over the last, several decades across the country is essentially that these formulas where you set a base year and try to kind of control growth over time, they just don't really work very well. So you should be comparing to previous years as opposed to, say government shouldn't grow more than X amount over last year, as opposed to saying, well, let's lock into 1980 and go forward. So that's one of the things that the Taxpayer Bill of Rights does. What it also does is it, instead of basically what Missouri's amendment does currently, is it's tied to personal income, which is an economic measure that can increase without, essentially, it can grow with the economy as opposed to something that really is locking in a set of services. So what Colorado has done, and places like Texas, a few others have found works much better, is tying growth to the rate of population growth and inflation. And so what that has shown to do is it essentially locks in a set of services. So if you look at Missouri's government today, really it shouldn't need to grow more than the rate of population, more people in the state, and the cost of goods. And if it's growing more than that, that means the scope of government is growing and voters should weigh in. And so the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, it includes more refunds, more opportunity for refunds, because it wouldn't be going out of date. It would include these tax credits, so there wouldn't be as much of a way to go around it. And what you see in Colorado, you see a state that is performing much better than Missouri. You see taxpayers there have received over $8 billion in the last few years in refunds, where Missourians haven't received any. And you see a way to more contain or more constrain the state budget growth. So with the rate that Missouri's on, something needs to change, and we do have some pretty clear data now to suggest that these pieces that Missouri voters approved just aren't working anymore, and so there are some ways to do better. And I think Missouri voters should get a chance to weigh in on that.
Someone should come up with a Missouri Taxpayer Bill of Rights. Someone should work on that and maybe preview it next week, Tuesday, April 30th in Columbia, with you and Aaron Hedlund. Just an idea.
That would be a good idea. I'll look around for it.
Okay, great. Tickets and information at showmeinstitute.org. Avery, the other news of the last week, Senate Bill 727, the Comprehensive Education Reform Bill. It had previously passed the Senate. Now it has passed the House. It is on to the governor's desk. We did a podcast with Susan Pendergrass and James Scholes. We had their reaction. But you talk about education. You research education here at Show Me Institute. So now I want to get your thoughts. What are your key takeaways from SB 727?
Yeah, the first thing you need to consider about this bill is, I think James put it correctly in the previous podcast, if you guys want to go listen to that, is that this is a compromise. You know, I do enjoy a lot of the things about the bill. There are some good things like pay differentiation, which I think is personally the best policy to come out of that, the most complete policy to come out of this bill. But at the same time, there are still, you know, issues that surround the bill. There's still things that we could improve, things that we can make better. I think Susan puts it correctly that we could publicly fund the ESA program. We could just, instead of tinkering with the funding formula, just completely overhaul it. And there are things that I'm excited for us to continue to work on, to continue to make better. This was a good first step, and I'm looking forward to seeing what more Missouri can do, and I'm thankful that it got passed.
One issue that you've talked about a lot this year, published a couple papers on, is the four-day school week. And there's some language in 727 that makes some changes to what some districts around the state might consider doing around the four-day school week. So can you tell us about some of those?
First, it will create a way that states, that the school districts that want to move to a four-day school week, that the citizens in that school district will get a chance to vote for it. But particularly, it's interesting that this part of it even was a compromise, that only those in a charter county or those who have at least 30,000 or more citizens will be able to vote on whether or not they move to a four-day school week, which is one of the issues I have with it. I think everyone, all districts should be able to vote, decide whether or not they want to move to a four-day school week. But it's particularly interesting that it only applies to these bigger districts. And in fact, when you look at it, only around 100 districts will be subject to this voting requirement, which is about 20% of the districts in our entire state. And then the second provision that you changed that you have is that five-day school week districts have to go to school 169 days, and four-day school week districts have to go to school 142 days. But in the same way, this only applies to the bigger districts. So these new minimums are only applying to the bigger districts, just like the new voting procedures are only applying to the bigger districts.
Really, I think one of the takeaways, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that you and James have from your research so far this year, is that even if you're a district that decides the four-day school week is the best fit for you, that you should make sure you look at all of the available information. There are districts that have made the change, and they have said the reason is cost savings, or the reason is teacher retention. And just briefly to remind listeners, what did you and James find about the impact of the four-day school week on those two things, cost savings and teacher retention?
So particularly, we looked at all the literature throughout the United States. And what we found in all the states that evaluated the four-day school week is that it doesn't really appear to save any money. The offset in cost is usually negated by a loss in revenue, because when you pay for lunches, when you provide lunches to students, you also have to, you know, there's usually students paying for them, or the federal government is paying for them through a program. So there's usually a wash in most costs, because the things that save money on, like bus routes and food, usually you're getting money either from the citizens themselves or from the federal or state government. And cost savings really is honestly going to be the big driving force for four-day school week change. And this bill, again, takes another stab at it, which it's a huge part of the fiscal note. I'm sorry I didn't get to this in the first part of my discussion, but they're going to provide a 2% aid bonus to districts which go over 169 days or more, which, of course, if you go to a four-day school week, you're not going to meet that mark. There's not many districts meet that mark right now. 466, or about 80% of our school districts, don't go to school 169 days or more. So when this bill gets changed, 2% of your total state entitlement will be given to you if you go over 169 days. And I think people put this because, you know, as you're asking, district finances is the biggest thing for moving to a four-day school week. I think people put this in this bill thinking that, yeah, this should be able to slow down a four-day school week. We should get some people to switch back from the four-day school week. And I really don't think it will. You know, James and I's research, we found that it doesn't really save you any money. But when you ask these districts themselves, they really are convinced that it saves them a lot of money. And when you look at, okay, we're going to give you 2% aid bonus, state entitlement bonus, if you go to 169 days or more, which essentially means you have to move to a five-day school week to do that. If you give those to those districts, that's only equivalent, I did the math, it's only equivalent to about 0.6% of their total cost. And these four-day school week districts think they're saving way more than that. So that part of the bill almost is just kind of wasteful to spend all that money to try to get people to move back to a five-day school week, and it's not going to happen. And I think that's what we just have to keep studying is what, how does it affect the financial aspect?
Sure. And finally, before we move on, I do want to talk about the fiscal note of 727, and I don't need you to give me a number, but I do want you to address, there are, we've seen several estimates from some from proponents of the bill, some from opponents of the bill. So again, I don't need a number, but is there anything, and Elias, you can jump in here too, is there anything that people should keep in mind when they hear these estimates being thrown around about what the changes in 727 are actually going to cost?
I think they should keep in mind this last part of the bill. It's like at the very end of the bill, the 2% aid bonus, and it's a huge portion of this fiscal note. It's, looking at it, it's about, if all the districts met this 169-day requirement, it'd be like between $75 to $100 million. I'm not going to give you an exact number because it's hard to determine, you know, exactly what qualifies and what doesn't qualify. But that's what the fiscal note reports, and that's what I've found. And it seems like, as Susan was talking about, we're still using tax credits to fund our ESA program. That's $75 to $100 million right there that if we just diverted it to publicly funding, it could make a big difference. And I think that it's just, I'm not a fan of that aid bonus. I think that's just throwing away a lot of money, and it's driving up the fiscal note a lot.
One thing from the fiscal note that I think is a slightly misleading is essentially that the state legislature was going to fund teacher pay, probably. They funded the minimum teacher pay last year. It was already sort of included in the budget, so that probably would have happened regardless of whether this bill went into effect or not. And so that is something that is kind of, it seems like it's a new cost, but really that was going to be in the budget anyways, which is something that I think legislators specifically have to keep in mind whenever they're, you know, putting together the budget right now, because as we're going forward and, you know, the cost of the budget keeps going up and revenues are going down, this idea of propping up teacher pay has been a bad one from the start. But, you know, what the bill does is it does kind of establish a way that it's going to continue going up. The minimum is going to continue going up, especially for, I think, with teachers with masters. And so there's additional costs coming that ties the state budget to continuing to fund this. And frankly, I think that was a really bad part of this bill.
And to tie it back to the Hancock Amendment, the problem with this minimum teacher pay is that the large majority of the districts that are under this new minimum teacher pay, because most of the districts in the St. Louis and Kansas City area are already well above the minimum teacher salaries. The ones that aren't and are going to get this bump are many of the rural school districts. And so that's going to be state dollars to increase their teacher pay. But that's absolutely, we talk about when voters vote for taxes, for school district tax rate increases, why would those voters ever again vote for a tax increase for their school district if the state is just going to fund their higher pay for their teachers? It's sort of a classic free rider problem. And that, so you'll have taxpayers in the greater St. Louis and greater Kansas City and Springfield areas that, you know, of course, pay the bulk of the taxes, both locally and state here, and their taxes are going to fund higher teacher salaries in rural Missouri for many taxpayers there who will clearly choose even more than they already do not to raise their own local taxes. So it's definitely a creation of an additional free rider problem here.
And Avery's written about this new blog up at showmeinstitute.org on 727. There'll be a lot more we have to say about this, and we'll see if the governor signs it. It goes to him now. David, speaking of, I guess,
free riders.
And just rider problems, yeah. You have your Cardinal shirt on. You're going to the game today. You taking the Metrolink?
No, but I will take a scooter. Does that count? I will take a Lime scooter.
I don't think, has Metro thought about expanding into scooter, fixed line scooters?
That would be fantastic.
All right,
I'll park in my normal spot and then take a scooter to the stadium from my normal parking spot.
All right, so previously we've been talking about this Metrolink proposed expansion in St. Louis, the north to south line, but recently people might have been hearing about a second front in the battle against Metrolink expansion. So you've written a blog post about it, and it's been in the news the last few days. What's the other expansion that people are hearing about?
Well, the other expansion is is underway and will be done in the not too distant future, and it's certainly less concerning. It's far less expensive, almost questionably so. And this is the expansion where Metrolink is now meeting the Mid-America Airport in southwestern Illinois in St. Clair County. The Mid-America Airport has been a classic financial boondoggle from the start. I sort of would equate Metrolink meeting up to Mid-America Airport sort of like when chocolate met peanut butter, if nobody ever ate chocolate or peanut butter. So you sort of have that here. But let's remember, with the Mid-America Airport, I quoted in a blog back in the 90s, consultants predicted 2 million passengers a year would come through Mid-America Airport when it was built. 2 million a year. Last year, 2022, it set its all-time record. That's the 2022 is the most current data. It set its all-time record for passengers at 163,000. So nowhere near the $2 million predicted for it. And now you've got, you know, we have this north-south line proposal in the city of St. Louis for Metrolink. And they're too proposing way, it's not even a large number they're proposing are going to use it, but it's not even going to hit that anyway. And I'm talking about predictions we saw that they released back in 2004, that by 2025 there'd be 80,000 Metro boardings a day on the Missouri side of the system. Right now there's about 16,000 a day on the Missouri side of the system.
Which is less. Like, it's fewer.
Both less and fewer, yeah. Depending on the grammar. So now you're taking Metrolink out from its further station in St. Clair, which I think is at Scott, and you're expanding it out to Mid-America Airport. This construction, it's $98 million for about a five-mile extension, which, by the math of transit expansion, isn't that bad. So I don't have any major problems with this expansion. And in Missouri, we're a Missouri-based think tank, and Missouri taxpayers aren't paying for this at all anyway, so I guess I doubly have no problem with it. But it is worth pointing out that the five-mile north-south extension in the city is estimated to cost $1.1 billion. It's the same length. One is $98 million, and one's estimated for $1.1 billion. It's astonishing. And I know that building in the city is tougher than building on cornfields, but it's not like they're building tunnels for this north-south proposal in the city of St. Louis. It's at grade. There's no tunnels at all. And they already have the right-of-way for it on Jefferson, so right-of-way acquisition costs are low. So how this, I get 8 or 9 new stations, probably explains a couple hundred million of it, but you're $700 to $800 million more for the same distance for an at-grade thing? It's astonishing. And just another example of why this north-south proposal in the city of St. Louis for Metrolink is such a ridiculous idea, and I very much hope we do not get federal funding for it.
Well, and you've written about for a long time projects, specifically in the city of St. Louis, St. Louis County. When you hear these estimates for projects, how often do they get completed on time and then say, actually, it costs right at or a lot less than we thought? That estimate was pretty dead on.
Almost never. And I'm familiar with one major study of just large government projects of all types. And the conclusion of this study was they're so continuously over time and over budget that it can't be an accident. That it's sort of, in order to sell these things to taxpayers, high-speed rail in California was sold. It would cost about $10 billion to do high-speed rail in 2008 when it was approved. It's now at an estimate cost of $135 billion, and they haven't laid a single line of track yet. So it's gone from 10 to $135 billion, and they haven't accomplished anything. These types of under-budgeted and unrealistic time frames are so consistent that it's pretty much intentional, that this is what governments do to get voters and taxpayers and politicians to approve it. And then once it starts and construction is underway, you're sort of stuck, so you have to pay the new money. And that's what we have seen with prior Metrolink expansions. Hopefully it won't be what we see with the one to Mid-America airport, because again, that's mostly through a lot of farmland right now. It probably has a much higher chance of being done on time and on budget. But this one in St. Louis, I'm sure that will, whatever their final budget estimate is, I would be stunned if it's on budget. It can happen. MoDOT's redoing of 6440 in St. Louis came in on time and on budget. So that's, it's not that it's impossible to happen. It's just extraordinarily rare.
When St. Louis Metro announces their plan to link the California project to the St. Louis Metro link as a new westward expand, you are going to be so mad.
So mad. Although they're now starting the high-speed rail from Vegas, from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, and they've used a private contractor to do this. They've gone out and put the bid out. The company that operates the Brightline rail service in Florida, which is this new private passenger rail service in Florida. It's not considered high-speed rail, but they've having tremendous success in Florida with actually convincing people to ride trains from Miami to Orlando on this private company there. And so they have a new division that's operating the high, that's supposed to be building. They've won the bid. They're starting a high-speed rail from LA to Vegas. So let's see if that might actually be a success.
All right, let's wrap up how we always do. What will you be watching over the next week? Elias, we will start with you.
Well, it's budget, budget, budget. We're looking at the Senate right now. They're going over, last night they worked a little bit late, going over their budget. And then, not to belabor the point too much, but what David brought up brings up a very important point. There was an article recently about how the Senate is considering adding a lot more money back to the budget. And part of that being the excess COVID dollars, so the American Rescue Plan dollars. But now what groups are looking for are essentially, because they haven't started their projects yet, they're now starting to come back to the state for more, essentially saying, okay, well, we were given this money last year or, sometime in the last year or two. And essentially now, if there was a match component, meaning how a lot of this federal money works is that recipients need to put up probably say 10%, and then the federal government will pay 90, something like that. Now they're coming back to the state and saying, well, we actually haven't started this because we didn't get the money for the match. So will you give us the match? And, you know, maybe this is going to cost more than we thought anyway. So, you know, hopefully you have a little bit money left after the end of this year in case we need to come back to finish this project. And I think as we're going through the budget this year, we're really getting to the point with the federal money running out that we're going to start seeing, were these dollars invested well? Are we seeing a lot of, projects uncompleted? You know, where are we at with things? Because there has been a lot of inflation. And the article, at least from the other day, was one of the first warning signs I've seen, but it's something that to kind of keep an eye on.
Avery?
The federal government's actually making some moves in the nuclear energy sector, and I'm hoping that Missouri can get on track as well. We have a couple laws, particularly the Construction Works in Progress Law, which was passed by the anti-nuclear lobby in order to stonewall the industry, which it has. And I'm hoping that we can repeal that law, make our state more nuclear friendly, and I want to see a second nuclear plant in Missouri.
And David?
Well, Terram Ripam Vici, of course. We'll have a video up on this shortly at showmeinstitute.org. Land banks must be defeated. If there's one thing that has to, if there's one terrible policy idea in Missouri that needs to be stopped, it's the expansion of land banks. Similarly, good ideas that we need to expand in Missouri are the prohibitions on municipal source of income rules, meaning states stepping in to prevent cities or counties from requiring landlords to accept source of income, and various other limits on how landlords can engage in their own in renting out their own property. That's a great policy for Missouri. And finally, a little bit of both. There's a bill to make some adjustments to the senior property tax freeze here in Missouri. I strongly oppose these senior property tax freezes. Much of this bill is pretty much basic, decent clarifications that doesn't do any harm. But one part of the bill says that cities and counties, including the city of St. Louis in this case, can't impose limits on who we can participate in these senior property tax freezes. And I think that's, in some respects, a very bad idea, but also maybe a good idea if it then convinces St. Louis City and St. Louis County, which have imposed those limits, to then ditch the program entirely. So sort of still trying to figure out how I feel about that one.
All right. Well, we'll check back when you have a better grasp on your feelings. David, Avery, Elias, thank you very much, and plenty more at showmeinstitute.org.